Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. I'm so delighted today to have Dr. Harrison Schmitt. He's an Apollo 17 astronaut who was on the moon for 3 days, a former U.S. senator for more than 45 years. He's been involved in astronomy as an astronaut with NASA for 10 years, 20 years as a consultant and businessman and professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's a huge advocate of space-based private enterprise. He is looking to establish and make sure that a new and permanent era of human enterprise and settlement in space happens. He is the author of the book, Return to the Moon, Exploration, Enterprise, and Energy in the Human Settlement of Space. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you as our guest. We're delighted. None of us have met anybody who spent 3 days on the moon. Thank you, Harrison Schmitt, for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, sir. First, I'd like you to share the emotionality, if you can go back to 1972, with your first impressions of going to the moon, being there, to just bring us in as an audience.
Well, if you are speaking of actually landing in the Valley of Taurus Littoral, once all of the technical and operational activities had been completed and we were indeed able to first look through the windows of the Challenger, the lunar module, and then a couple hours later actually get out of the spacecraft onto the surface and begin to work, you could not help, at least I could not help, but be tremendously impressed by two things. One is the fact that we were there, and others had been there on the moon prior to us. And two, how magnificent this particular valley in which we landed was to the eye. We were in a valley deeper than the Grand Canyon. The mountains on either side went up to over 7,000 feet. We were essentially in the narrowest part of the valley with only about 7 miles wide at the point where we were. So we had a view of these brilliantly illuminated mountain walls with their steep slopes from top to bottom, almost constant at 26 degrees. The sun was as bright as any New Mexico sun that I've ever seen, of course, with no atmosphere to attenuate its rays. But I think the hardest thing to get used to when you're there, and probably never get used to, is that the sky with a brilliant sun is black, absolute black. We're used to having a blue sky, as I see here in New Mexico today, and still trying to imagine what the mountains outside my window would look like with an absolute black sky is very difficult for the human mind to encompass, I think.
So you're literally in black and white. For visual.
You are, and shades of gray from blue to brown to light grays of various kinds. The pulverized surface of the moon is so finely pulverized that it, like any mineral or rock, when it's pulverized, turns to a gray color with different shades. But still, everything's so brilliantly illuminated that it's quite a magnificent place to be.
It has been said that many astronauts who have been to the moon have a life change. There's something on a perspective level that, from an internal place, changes. Did you experience that at all?
Well, I don't think you would find many astronauts to say that. A couple might. But most of us, I think, just had an opportunity to be astronauts who went to the moon. And that changed the way people viewed our subsequent activities. Just about everybody that I know, in fact, is I would say everybody that I know that's been to the moon is basically was the same type of person that I knew in the astronaut program.
Okay, got it. The capital investment you discussed in your book, Return to the Moon, at the time of your writing was less than $15 billion or similar to the 1970s of a transatlantic pipeline in the 1980s for a Eurotunnel to bring a shuttle to the moon.
Trans-Alaskan Pipeline.
Trans-Alaskan Pipeline. Thank you, I stand corrected. right now, do you think that number's different?
Oh, no. I think with the economy as it has been since then, the price of coal, although it went up significantly in, I believe, 07, 08, has come back down to about the $2.50 per million BTU that I use to calculate competitiveness. I think all of that has probably ended up with those estimates still being about right. Now, you've got to remember, this is an investor entrepreneurial effort and not a government effort. The government effort to do the same thing, if heaven forbid it, we let the government do it that way, would probably cost about 10 times what a private sector estimate effort would cost. Private entrepreneurial enterprises just do things differently. You have to think costs all the time. And unfortunately, we don't make our government think that.
I felt that your book was so detailed. It was like a galactic business plan for exploration, enterprise, and energy in the human settlement of space. That's how much detail it had in it.
Well, that was its intent, in part. I also intended to hope that most people could understand most of it. But also, it basically outlined all aspects of the kinds of things that a business plan to go back to the moon and harvest its energy resources would require.
Talk about helium-3. I had heard about helium-3 years ago, and I never had anybody verify that that was one of the most useful and highly doable and important energy sources. And when you started to list all of them, from renewables to wind to hydrogen, I was very excited. But you talk about it. You're the one who had direct contact with it.
Well, the samples returned by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the Apollo 11 mission showed us that, as anticipated by four different teams of scientists, showed us that the soils of the moon contain solar wind gases, gases or atoms that have come from the solar wind as a result of the fusion processes that take place on the sun and in the sun. They had been collected on the moon over literally billions of years. And it was anticipated that they would be found in the samples, and indeed they were. One of those gases is helium, and an isotope, a light isotope of helium-4, which is what you normally get in your balloons, is helium-3. And there is a, it was discovered some 13 years later by a group of nuclear engineers at the University of Wisconsin under the leadership of Dean Kolsinski, that the concentrations that had been measured by these scientists in the Apollo 11 samples would be of economic interest if one could put together the overall enterprise necessary to collect it and bring that helium-3 back to Earth. It had long been known to physicists and engineers in that business that if you had helium-3 here on Earth, it would be a nearly ideal fuel for fusion power. Unfortunately, there's just not very much here, enough for various reasons that one can do research, but not enough that you could ever base a energy enterprise on its availability. And so they contacted me back in 1986 and asked me if I would act in a consulting capacity to the Wisconsin group and to try to understand better the nature of that resource, what we would call the economic geology of that resource, and begin to think in terms of just what would it take in order to bring helium-3 back to Earth and to design fusion reactors that could utilize it to produce electricity. The reason it's such an advantage over other types of nuclear energy sources is that in its in the form which allows one to fuse helium-3 with itself, you get absolutely no radioactivity produced, residual radioactivity that one would have to dispose of. You can convert the energy of the helium-3 fusion to electricity at about a 70% efficiency. Those two things mean that it would have, if you had it, a tremendous advantage over other nuclear energy sources. It's really quite exciting, but of course you have to have the capability to go to the moon, to mine that material on the moon, and to process it, refine it, and bring the helium back to Earth. In the process of doing that, you're going to create a lot of other resources that are of tremendous value in space. But the only part of that solar wind resource base, as you might call it, that would be potentially economical to bring back to Earth is the helium-3.
You say each 100 kilograms of helium-3 will require 10 million tons of regolith. Describe what regolith is.
The regolith is a term we geologists apply to certain types of debris that has been derived primarily from the underlying rock material. It's used here on Earth for that purpose, and on the moon, pulverized material that covers the moon is indeed regolith that has been produced by the impact of meteors and micrometeors over geologic time. At the Apollo 11 site, it averages about 6 meters deep. The Apollo 17 site, where I explored, it is about 9 meters deep, but there's a very special reason of why it's deeper there than elsewhere. Over the moon, on the average, in the older parts of the moon, the older surface of the moon, that debris layer is probably on the order of 6 meters deep. Now, of course, it's irregular, but that's the average.
You say that terrestrial solar power and renewable energy is kind of in the box, but it's very expensive.
It's only competitive now. The windmills that you see all over California and other parts of the world are only competitive now, and other solar energy sources are only competitive now because they're subsidized. The taxpayer is paying to subsidize the cost over what they would require if left to their own economic devices. There are a few places where solar panels can be economic on their own without a subsidy. Space is one of those places because it's a very useful way to produce electricity for things like the space station. But if you're going to do it for here on Earth for what one would legitimately call commercial purposes, right now all forms of solar energy really do require being subsidized, not only on their own because of the cost of the technology is significantly higher than an equivalent amount of energy being produced by other systems. But since the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow, you have to also have, as backup, other types of power sources, coal or nuclear in principle. And once you reach a certain level of the excess capacity of your power grid, your normal power grid that is being served by coal and nuclear, then you have to build some more coal and or nuclear plants in order to continue to have that backup. And that's just another cost that generally is not considered in the what people think is the cost of solar energy. You do have to provide that backup when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow.
Why are people so in love with hydrogen and excited about building a hydrogen economy? What is it?
Well, it's hard to say. I think it's ideological more than anything else. If you do a rational economic analysis, hydrogen is probably the least competitive of the so-called clean fuels. The reason is that you have to produce hydrogen from something, and until we have a way to produce it in large quantities other than through electrolysis or through the cracking of natural gas, where most of hydrogen is produced today, it's not going to be economic. It's a very inefficient way to store energy. Hydrogen is basically a battery. You have to use a lot of electricity to produce it, and then you get only a small fraction of that electricity back when you convert it to water and electrons.
I know that this current administration is basically stating that it doesn't want to continue any more space explorations at this time with regard to NASA. Does it really matter at this point if you're proposing through your work a parallel system be developed for private enterprise where people would cooperate in the free market instead of having NASA run it?
Well, they're apples and oranges.
Okay.
I certainly don't think the government should be in the business of doing something that that investors would do or a private enterprise effort would undertake, and that would be the production of commercial helium-3 fusion power here on Earth using lunar sources of helium-3. I think the private sector could do that. Now, it's not easy because investors could not anticipate a return on their investment directly from that enterprise for 15 to 20 years. Fortunately, there are ways, as I outline in the book, there are ways to realize a return on investment through the spinoff of various technologies on the way to helium-3 fusion power. But still, I think it certainly makes strong sense, and there are very strong arguments that the energy part of returning to the moon it should be done by the private sector and by private investment. The government's role in returning to deep space, as articulated well by many over the last several years, has a much broader rationale from a geopolitical point of view. The United States has many competitors in this world, China, Russia, and others, and Europe, not to be ignored. And it is extremely important in posturing ourselves to be competitive geopolitically and economically to be active in this new ocean of space. Others will be there and are there, and if the United States should decide that it's not going to be a player, a competitive player in space, then I think it will have ramifications and reverberations throughout the future of this country as well as the future of humankind.
You speak about out-of-the-box different types of energy sources worth mentioning. Deuterium and tritium fusion?
Yeah, that is the so-called DT fusion. Deuterium tritium fusion has been worked on now for many, many decades, not only here in the United States but throughout the world, sometimes cooperatively and sometimes competitively. And right now it is and has been for some time the major national and international research effort that in the area of developing fusion power. Unfortunately, there are many disadvantages to that to the use of those two fuels to produce electricity. The primary disadvantage is that you will never be very efficient with it. It'll never get better than what a coal plant or a nuclear plant can do today. And it will produce more radioactive material that has to be disposed of than even the existing fission nuclear plants that we have operating throughout the world. Those two things in and of themselves, I think, undercut any kind of long-term commercial value to DT fusion research. In addition, the capital cost of plants that would enable you to use DT fusion to produce electricity will be very, very high. That system requires the use of extremely large and costly magnets, very, very high intensity magnets, and that plus a number, many, many other factors make the cost of any kind of a fusion power plant of that nature very high. In the case of helium-3, you can, instead of having to use magnetic confinement primarily, you can use electrostatic confinement, because the reaction products, as well as the fuels themselves, can be ionized. That is, they can have electrical charges and be manipulated by electrostatic fields rather than magnetic fields. And that is very, very important in reducing the capital costs. And we've already talked about the fact that you can potentially eliminate any radioactive waste, and you can probably double the efficiency of the plant over existing power plants.
About 10 years ago, there was a treasure ship. It's in the book Ship of Gold by Gary Kinder. This man named Tommy Thompson raised $100 million to go in and find this particular ship in the ocean. And as he got going, found out that all new types of technology needed to be created to bring it up. So this particular venture is a microcosm, to me, of part of what's going to happen with returning to the moon, which is that as the commitment of finances are happening and the groups or the individuals commit and get going, all these new technologies and capabilities are going to be born from it that are just as huge along the way. And I think that a lot of people don't know that's what happens when you commit to large-scale projects. All new types of applications and income opportunities and inventions and technologies come about along the way. My next question to you is a difficult one. I was wondering why NASA bombed the moon some months ago. I don't understand it, and it has nothing to do with what you're proposing, but do you know why that was done? And if you do, could you share why they did that?
Well, that's an interesting choice of words, bombing the moon. What NASA did was launch off the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is currently operating very productively in lunar orbit. They launched off of that spacecraft a probe that impacted into a permanently shadowed part of a crater at the south pole of the moon. At the time of impact, they had a large number of instruments watching to see what kind of materials would be released by the mechanical as well as the heat energy of that impact. And hoping to determine quantitatively how much water might be present and other elements might be present in the permanently shadowed parts of the polar regions of the moon. Those permanently shadowed areas are extremely cold, like they're down at just, say, 40 degrees above absolute zero, which is extraordinarily cold. And they act as cold traps for any kind of solar wind gases, water produced by various reactions that might migrate over geologic time. We're talking about billions of years, or millions of years anyway. And they would be deposited, attracted statistically into these cold traps. And that was the reason, scientific reason, for NASA doing that. I think it was called L-Cross probe that hit into the permanently shadowed crater.
The media is who was writing bombing of the moon. So that's why I used the expression, because I don't know anything about it, and I just saw, NASA's bombing the moon. So
it does relate indirectly to the question of what is the distribution of helium-3 on the moon, in that the evidence is very strong now that hydrogen, which also comes to the moon from the solar wind as protons and then captures an electron to become hydrogen again and is embedded in the lunar regolith just as helium is, that hydrogen, evidence is very strong that hydrogen concentrations increase as you approach the north and south poles. And that most certainly is because, again, of cold trapping, that it's just not as hot. And less hydrogen is lost after it's been embedded in the lunar regolith as you approach the poles than would be the case at the equator. If hydrogen is being concentrated towards the poles and in permanently shadowed areas, then helium almost certainly is also. So even though the book analysis that I made relates to the near equatorial concentrations of helium-3 as shown by the samples, the regular samples brought back by Neil Armstrong. We now know the probability is very high, although we do not yet have samples. but the probability is very high that helium concentrations increase as you go north and south, probably as much as by a factor of three. And, of course, that would help the economics of mining and processing helium-3 a great deal.
And speaking of mining, you shared about how mining would be an incredible adventure on the moon and that we may need an entire new mining system.
Well, conceptually, the mining will probably be very not unlike large-scale mine, what we call large-tonnage mining here on Earth. From a technology point of view, you need a great deal more automation than is normally used here on Earth. You're going to need very high reliability because of access for repair is not quite as easy as it is here on Earth. There are just going to be a number of very interesting and exciting for engineers challenges that have to be met in order to develop these mining machines that can, say, produce 100 kilograms of helium-3 for a 1,000-megawatt plant here on Earth on an annual basis. I have no doubt that that those kinds of machines can be developed. They're based on bucket wheel concepts and other engineering concepts that are not new. It's just that you have to make them perform in a very hostile and different kind of environment. Now, mining on Earth has gone into very hostile and difficult environments before here on Earth. And so managing a mining town, if you will, on the moon conceptually has been done before. It's just that the whole thing is being done in a different, shall we say, cosmic environment than what we're used to here on Earth. But many of the concepts are the same. For example, you want people to be permanent residents of that mining town. You don't want to keep having to ferry people back and forth. And so you'll be looking for technicians and miners and scientists who are willing to basically go to the moon to live. And that will reduce the cost significantly and is one of the factors that is important to making this whole enterprise economic.
I think we will also need a new type of bank, and it would be a good place to start on the moon. Maybe Earth can learn from the moon.
Thomas Jefferson told us that a little revolution here and there is not bad, and I suspect that a settlement that develops on the moon with its economy based on helium-3 and other resource development there will at some point decide they want to be independent, at least politically independent of the Earth. They're tired of taxation without representation, and they will probably give us a new experiment in how a new and free settlement can actually be developed in that new environment. It's quite exciting, as a matter of fact.
I love the fact that you talked about everything from radiation and moon dust and needing the suits to be sealed against dust. But I was shocked to hear that dust is more of a concern than space radiation. Why?
Well, space radiation, you know exactly what you have to do to protect yourself from it, and that is put a reasonable shell of water around your habitats and places where you're working. And that will protect you from the solar particle events, and depending on how much you put there, it'll protect you from cosmic radiation to some degree as well. So we know exactly what to do about radiation. Dust is going to be a bit of a more engineering challenge. I say we know what to do. It's just, again, it's going to be an engineering challenge to make sure that this extremely fine abrasive material is kept out not only of moving parts of your mining machine, but also you don't want it to migrate into your habitats. But there again, we have an advantage in dealing with it, in that essentially every one of those very small particles is slightly magnetic. It has little tiny pieces of iron in it produced by these micrometeor impacts that happen on the moon continuously. And because it has that iron and is slightly magnetic, you can use magnetic brushes and filters and a number of different ways in which to keep your habitat clean. So I'm not a person that is very worried about the dust. I think, again, there's some engineering challenges that have to be overcome. But I know enough engineers who are excited about overcoming those that I don't think that's a problem.
You write on page 46 of your book that the moon is resource-rich, and there's an international space station there and a lunar base that's been envisioned by NASA. But with your proposal, which is like a parallel effort, these travels are going to be landing people precisely at known spots. There are lunar experts. They're shipped to do their work in space. And one of the things you said was that it wouldn't be these generic broad-based trips. They would be very specific. They'd be landing in specific areas where mining is going to be done or settlement's going to happen. Can you speak about that? Because that seemed like there was a possibility of a huge economy of scale with regard to space travel. And I could see it when you wrote it in the book.
Well, if you are... If you can meet the cost parameters that I outline in the book, particularly for launch costs from Earth to the Moon, and that target is about $3,000 a kilogram payload to the Moon, then you have opened up a large number of other opportunities for activities in space as well as on the Moon. That $3,000 a kilogram cost target is about 20 times less than what the marginal cost of the Apollo 17 mission was in terms of launch costs. Now, reducing costs by a factor of 20, it may sound like an awful lot, but you've got to remember that from other technologies and what has happened to costs of other technologies, it's not very much. And indeed, since the design of the Saturn V rocket, upon which my estimates were based, is now a 50-year-old design, it's hard to believe, but that rocket was being designed 50 years ago, there is no question in my mind or in Michael Griffin's mind, the former NASA administration, or anybody else's mind who's thought about it, that those costs can't be reduced by many, many factors. With new materials, new computer manufacturing techniques, just any number of things are going to make those costs go down. If, again, the private sector does it. If the government does it, I can't tell you how the costs are going to go.
They'll probably escalate into the infinite like they are now.
Now, just as I was writing that book, of course, Mike Griffin and his colleagues at NASA were looking at developing the Ares rocket systems, Ares 1 and Ares 5, and if that effort, or certainly had it proceeded, the investors and the corporation developed for helium-3 access from the moon would have to look at the cost structure for those rocket systems and see how it compared with what they might be able to do with a uprated Saturn V. What I call in the book a Saturn VI, and that is a trade study that I haven't done and would have to be done sometime in the future if new rocket systems became available. My gut tells me that Saturn VI, uprated Saturn V, for the long haul, commercial haul, will turn out to be more cost effective, but I don't know that for sure.
Do you think that we would ever be able to use helium-3 to get to the moon?
Probably not to get to the moon. It's just a too short a trip. But fusion rockets, helium-3 is particularly amenable to very efficient fusion rockets. And when you talk about enabling trips to Mars, then it would definitely would become a player. If you have developed economical fusion power systems here on Earth, then you will have done essentially all the technology work necessary to build a fusion rocket using helium-3 that could accelerate you to Mars and the halfway there, say, just for simplicity, and then decelerate as you get closer. And that could significantly shorten the time required for a trip to Mars. And that's very important. We really need to do that. Using chemical rocket systems or minimum energy systems, as they're sometimes called, we're looking at generally 8 to 9 month one-way trip to Mars, and you certainly, from a biomedical point of view, would like to shorten that as much as you possibly can.
How amenable has NASA been to your proposal, Return to the Moon, the book and all the detail in it?
Well, I would have to say that NASA engineers and Mike Griffin, when he was administrator, and others were very supportive. Mike Griffin acted as an editor of the book and of the manuscript. So, conceptually, they don't have any, as far as I know, nobody has any real problem with it. But practically, it is something that the United States government was not in a position to pursue because of its long-term commitment to this other form of fusion power research we talked about, deuterium tritium, and a very, very strong lobby within the Department of Energy, within the White House Office of Science and Technology and elsewhere, to stick with that path for both, domestic political reasons as well as for international political reasons. And so NASA was never in a position politically within the Bush administration, or certainly not within this current administration, to become an advocate of a private enterprise effort to harvest helium-3 from the moon. And so I really don't expect, until that changes, that the United States government will show much interest in this project. Now, other nations, China, Russia, Japan, India now a little bit, have begun to talk a great deal about helium-3, at least publicly. I don't know what they're doing internally to pursue the technology, but nevertheless, press releases have on many occasions mentioned their interest in helium-3 fusion and in going to the moon to get that resource.
Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic obviously is spending a ton of money on making private space travel possible in the next few years. And I'm wondering if he would be a potential player in helium-3 energy, because he has said many times that he is interested in providing new sources of energy, if he would be a right fit for something like this on a private level.
You'd have to talk to Branscombe about that. His interest right now is in a much, much lower level of space travel, namely just providing a suborbital flight to people and getting to the point of where you have you can commercially undertake an effort of the scale that is required for developing helium-3 fusion based on lunar resources. That's a whole...
Right. I get that. It's a whole other gestalt. It's a whole other universe of seriousness. But it would just seem to me his fascination in exploration and discovery and adventure would make him a kind of an interesting...
Well, he's been a hard man to get a hold of.
But, yes. Well, you got to catch him in a balloon or on an island and maybe on a plane, you know?
We have the people who have been interested in this, particularly myself, have talked to a lot of potential angel investors as well as venture capitalists. It's well beyond anything a venture capitalist would be interested in, but you learn by talking to people like that. And it really is a kind of an effort that is waiting for one or two or three or some number of what we call angel investors who are not interested in an immediate return on investment, but are interested in pursuing an opportunity that may turn out to be very, very big sometime in the future.
You talk in the book about risk, and you mentioned the several disasters that have happened with NASA and the flights to the moon. You talk about fail to operate, fail to manual, fail to safe. Can you describe to the public what that is? I thought that was an important point about kind of restructuring the way NASA is doing things.
Well, that referred specifically to the mining and processing machines. Since each machine, in a sense, would be contractually obligated to produce a certain amount of helium-3 for an operating fusion power plant here on Earth. You have to have those fusion power plants conceptually demonstrated before you're ever going to start to really put mining machines on the moon. But once you start to do that, the contractual obligation means that you want to minimize the risk of a miner shutting down and not being able to meet its contractual obligations. And so if you think of it this way, you've got a mining machine operating on the moon, probably with a crew of two that is acting to oversee that operation at any given time. There'd be continuous miners. And then you have a failure. Well, you want that failure to not affect that continuous operation, automatic operation. And then if you have a second failure, you want to be able for that crew to operate the machine manually. So again, you're not reducing the rate at which you're producing helium-3. And then in the final level, if you have a fourth failure, then you want the machine to shut down and safe itself so that you can repair it. But you also, having said all that, at any given time, you want to be able, while the machine's operating, you want to be able to repair, you want to be able to replace parts that need to be replaced because they're just aging. You want what you call embedded diagnostics so that you can continually monitor the critical parts of the machine and so forth. So you look at a machine that's going to just be up there operating indefinitely. And that's a new engineering concept. We did not build a space station, for example, to last indefinitely. We should have exercised these conceptual engineering concepts of indefinite life with the space station, but we did not. And so someday, it may be 2020, it may turn out 2025, the space station is going to re-enter the atmosphere, and it's just not going to be functional anymore. When you're talking about mining operations on the moon, you want these miners to operate essentially indefinitely.
In the United States, we tend to be a now culture. We are focused on the now, and it's very difficult for many people to look out into the future 20, 30 years, or 40 years, or even 50 years. And I notice in your book you use 2050 as a benchmark a lot, like there's a concern for meeting some timeline of 2050. Is there a particular reason it's 2050? Is it population-oriented, or where did you get that number?
Well, it is a figure that has been used and was being used around the turn of this century as a benchmark for how much energy the population at that time, if it stabilized at about 10 to 12 billion people on the planet, how much energy they would need just to subsist, and then how much energy, more energy, would be required to meet their aspirations. And so it's a convenient mid-century number. It's arbitrary. You can pick almost any number. It's just one that people have often used, and you can find statistical data to around that number to support your arguments.
You also said that there are organizational approach options for a return to the moon, and you mentioned six of them. U.S. only, multilateral but led by the USA, Intelsat model, encompassing the 1979 Moon Agreement, private/U.S. government partnerships, and private/government-funded lunar RDT&E, and then all private. And I'm wondering, what are you going for? What do you think is the best for the situation that really deals with what we have to do?
Well, based on the analysis I did in that chapter, and had done some time prior to that, and just updated, I think from a cost point of view and high probability of success point of view, that the all private is much preferable. Now, when we say all private, you of course realize that the government, if it's a United States entity that's undertaking this, that the United States government will be a player. It's a player in terms of taxation. It's a player in terms of regulation. The law requires that launch vehicles be approved pass muster, and that now the law actually requires also that whatever you bring back to Earth has to be meet certain regulatory criteria. So
who
the government's a player.
Who authorizes that? Who has to approve it?
Right now it's the Department of Transportation, I think, is the main regulatory player in all of that. Of course, the Congress and whatever levels of corporate taxation they decide on, that's a player as well. That's part of your cost. And also, I think the United States government would have to be sympathetic to the enterprise. They have to be your supporter in international fora. There are people who, in other countries, who interpret the Moon Treaty of 1967, not the Moon Treaty, but the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, as not authorizing an enterprise of the kind I describe in the book Return to the Moon. I think that's an erroneous, and I think it's a politically motivated interpretation, but nevertheless, the United States would have to be your supporter in that, indeed, a properly licensed entity could go to the moon, extract the helium-3 resources, and bring them back to Earth for commercial operations. I think the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 clearly makes that possible and should be interpreted in that way. But if the United States government decides to go the other direction, well, then you're pretty much dead in the water. So the government's a player, no question about it. Financially, you would like to do it with investors.
And you talked about a need for a new treaty. How would that happen?
Well, I don't think you need a new treaty.
Really?
I think the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 is perfectly adequate for
it has enough protection.
This kind of an operation, as it involves the United States and its entrepreneurs. The one thing that might be helpful would be at least a multilateral agreement to recognize a certain what we would call a claims regime on the moon, so that claims would a set of mining claims under certain constraints of size and time and implementation, that those claims would effectively be negotiable private property. That would certainly, I think, help in attracting future investors to this enterprise, and certainly would give a entity that's that's developing a settlement a way to reward their settlers with grants of land and that kind of thing. And that, though I don't think needs to be a full-fledged international treaty, it can be done by multilateral agreements between players that are actually going to go to the moon.
That's great. On page 300 of your book, you talked about humans versus robots in space, and a lot of people think just send robots up there. You don't need to send humans up there. I thought it was interesting that you said there's a huge amount of evidence from the Apollo work that the economic costs of robots are very prohibitive. With nanotechnology moving as fast as it is, do you think that nanotechnology could play a role in the robotics up there or no?
Well, technology will play a role. You need to be using robotics. In fact, that is as I indicated earlier, that's the big challenge, I think, economic challenge of building these miners, is that they basically work in a largely automated way and continuously. But I am not yet of the opinion that they can be repaired and monitored without humans present on the spot. And I think it's going to turn out to be much more efficient to have humans in that capacity on the miners, associated with the miners, than it would be to try to operate everything remotely from the Earth. I just can't yet. Maybe it's my age, but I can't yet imagine that happening. And that having a small crew of people involved on the moon as possible is important, but you're still going to have them involved.
Got it.
Human beings are costly. There's no question about it. But on the other hand, having a machine fail because you didn't have a human being there is even more costly.
Some people would say machines don't have consciousness, and that's why you should have people up there, because you have this discernment factor. But then if you ask Ray Kurzweil, he'll tell you that machines have consciousness, so who knows?
Yeah, sometimes you think they do if you're trying to operate.
They take on a life of their own. Talk about space medicine and your experience on the moon and the microgravity environment, and what happens to an astronaut on the moon? What do they go through in their biology?
Well, we really don't know yet, because we have not had the time on the moon or developed the protocols when we had a little bit of time to really understand whether or not the moon, how different the moon is from the weightlessness of space itself. We know a lot about, not nearly enough, but we know a lot about the changes the human body goes through when it's exposed to weightlessness and the relatively high concentrations of oxygen. We don't know how that changes when the gravity is 1/6 rather than zero. And that's a very, very important thing to know. And if and when we finally do get back to the moon, it's one of the things that we've recommended very strongly. When I was chair of the NASA Advisory Council, that we very early on try to understand if 1/6 gravity overcomes the adverse effects of adverse biological effects of weightlessness. If it does, then that changes a lot of the engineering concepts one would use to work on Mars, because that means Mars will reset those and overcome those adverse consequences. If we find that 1/6 gravity is not enough, then we're going to have to design in our operations as well as hardware, I think, much differently for going to Mars. So that one factor of understanding the effect of 1/6 gravity on human biological function is a very, very critical, what they sometimes call Mars forward factor that we need to understand.
Why are we so interested in Mars? What is it about Mars?
Hey,
tell us.
There.
How about the other ones? Pluto just got knocked off the whole grid out there. What happened?
That only in some people's minds. Let's face it. Mars is the next big goal in space. You don't know what you're on. We didn't know we were going to find helium-3 concentrations on the moon worth thinking about either. That's the excitement and value of exploration is you don't know what's going to be over the next hill.
The fluid shifts in your upper body. You have a loss of appetite. It's written that you have a decrease in bone density, a loss of muscle mass and heart mass. Your spine changes when you're in space. What happened to you on the moon? Did you feel anything different? Did you get sick to your stomach? Did you throw up? What happened to you?
No, the moon was a very comfortable place to be. And I think all of the astronauts have found that. And that's why I suspect that we're going, well, first we had 3.5 days to adapt to weightlessness on the way to the moon. And that's about what it takes to get over the immediate symptoms some of which you described. But on the moon, everybody felt good. The adrenaline was high, of course. And I have a feeling that 1/6 gravity starts to reset a lot of those adverse problems that we've seen in weightlessness. But we don't know that. We need to have that. And also, let's face it, neither the United States nor the then Soviet Union and now Russia have done a very good job of developing a very strong, rigorous research program for understanding not only the general space adaptation issues, but also individual variability in how adaptation occurs and variability in adverse consequences. I've been arguing with NASA for 40 years on that subject. And until we really put together a systematic protocol to understand the broad individual variations, we're going to be working partially in the dark on these kinds of subjects. For example, you talked about bone density changes. Well, generally, most astronauts and cosmonauts that have been examined for bone density changes do lose bone mineral mass. with exposure to weightlessness. On the other hand, there are a few that don't.
Wow.
We need to understand that. We need to understand why some don't. And also we find that, and this is of very great interest to some researchers in the National Institutes of Health, we find that when healthy astronauts come back, even with a depleted bone mineral mass, they gradually replace it. Well, that doesn't happen in older people. And the NIH folks would really like to understand why it works in astronauts and doesn't work in older people. So there's a great deal of, feedback from what we learn about the human physiology in space that is going to affect our understanding of human physiology here on Earth.
I love the part where you talked about NIH cooperating with NASA, but NASA hasn't been yet ready for that.
They certainly weren't at the time I wrote that book. During my tenure as the chairman of the NASA Advisory Council, through the efforts of Dr. Stephen Katz and Dr. David Longnecker, who were on the council, we were able to get a very strong working memorandum of understanding between the NIH and NASA, the first really good one that I think has ever been put together. Unfortunately, under the current administration, I'm not sure that's being pursued by NASA as it should.
Do you think that the current administration is shutting down funding for NASA because NASA's perceived as operating over budget and kind of runs fat, if you will, in the way it operates as an organization, and therefore it's seen as being non-fiscally responsible?
No. First of all, what they're shutting down is the funding for previous administration's vision for returning to the moon and going on to Mars. That's what they're shutting down, and that's a political decision.
Okay.
And the money for NASA's budget is staying roughly the same, if not increasing a little bit, but they're transferring they're proposed to Congress to transfer the money that would have been used by Constellation to return to the moon over into a variety of other science as well as climate and other programs of that nature. It's a change of emphasis, not a change of funding.
Okay.
They argue that the Constellation program was behind schedule and could not be implemented, could not be executed at the current levels of NASA's budget. Well, to some degree, that was true, but that was true because, one, the Bush administration never provided the funds early on that were necessary to keep schedules, and two, the Congress had several continuing resolutions, each of which reduced NASA's budget automatically. And anytime you cut funding in an agency like NASA for a major engineering program, you have to stretch out schedules. So that sort of became a self-fulfilling prophecy on the part of this administration. This administration doesn't understand technology programs. They really don't. They're all lawyers, almost to a person, and they really don't understand what it takes in order to run a coherent and a well-managed program and keep it on schedule. And they're making up stories about what's wrong with the Constellation program rather than looking at reality.
Do you think that there's a specific agenda associated with this administration and a preference for energy technologies, that he's already focused on those and off and running like a train going down the track?
Well, there is. This administration on the energy side of things definitely does not like nuclear, in spite of what they professed with their loan guarantees. That's a whole different subject. Again, that's a red herring, in my opinion. They want somehow to have these so-called green energies, energy systems that are totally uneconomic unless the taxpayer pays through the nose in order to support them, or the ratepayer pays through the nose to support them. I think the basic motivation of this administration is they don't want America to be great.
I know that you do not agree with the diagnosis relative to climate. I've done about, 13, 14 shows on climate and weather, and I used to be believer, I will say, in global warming until I got into the fine print and the detail. And so now I'm humbled and shaken, and I understand that there's really not a problem with it. But I was wondering if you wanted to spend a minute or two just sharing your take on it, your perspective on climate and carbon.
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that there is global warming that's been going on since the last ice age, 12,000 years ago. And more immediately, we've been warming since the little ice age from about 1400 to about 1900. And that there has been actually about 3.5 centuries of very gradual warming at about 0.5 degree per 100 years. That's happening. That's nature. It certainly didn't have anything to do with the Industrial Revolution. It's been going on so long. But that's a long-term trend. And within that long-term trend, you get both accelerated warming and accelerated cooling along that curve of gradually rising temperature. And to think that somehow or another, dealing with carbon emissions by human beings is going to affect this massive influence that nature has on our climate is just being absolutely ridiculous. It's not going to happen. You're going to spend if you did it, you'd spend a heck of a lot of money. You'd damage the American economy in major ways, and you'd get nothing for it, other than maybe feeling good that you're trying to do something. But it's something that is going to be totally ineffective. The now, what is causing this these variations in climate, both short term and long term? The evidence, I think, as a geologist now, is very, very strong that it has to do with the way in which solar radiation affects the Earth's energy budget. And that has been demonstrated fairly well for the very long-term ice ages that have occurred throughout Earth history. And increasingly, we're finding good, strong evidence that it's affecting the short-term climate changes as well through the variations that solar magnetic fields cause in the cosmic ray, the flux of cosmic rays that hit the Earth. That affects cloud formation and therefore affects how much light is going to be reflected from the Earth's atmosphere. So there, it's a very, very complex system that we call the Earth's climate, far too complex for the models that they're talking about to model in any kind of effective way. And the models themselves, every time they've been asked to do a forecast, have turned out to be wrong, whether it's a backcast or a forecast. The best example of that is that the models, all the so-called global climate models, all say that the Earth's upper atmosphere, what's called the troposphere, should be warming since we've been looking at it and starting in 1979. And in fact, it has remained constant in temperature, if not slightly cooled. So just in that one regard, that the climate models have been a failure. And we should not put our national economy up against those failed climate models.
What did you learn as a senator, being in the trenches as a senator for 6 years, that you're comfortable to share with us?
I learned that almost everybody who's there has one goal in mind, and that is to, until this last couple months, has one goal in mind, and that is to get reelected. Somehow or another, the current administration has been able to persuade a large number of congressmen and senators that getting reelected is not as important as taking over the economy, the private economy of the United States of America, and that is something I have not figured out yet. But while I was there, the orientation of almost everybody was to figure out a way to stay reelected. There were a few of us, I like to say, there are a few of us that were thinking about national interests more than their own political interests, but unfortunately not very many.
Were you disheartened?
No, I was very excited about being a senator. I learned a heck of a lot, like going to graduate school in political science. And for 6 years, it really was something that was very exciting to me, and I enjoyed very much. Volunteered to go back, but in the recession of 1982, the voters of New Mexico decided that they would rather have someone else.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to Dr. Harrison Schmitt, the Apollo 17 astronaut who was the last man on the moon. We've been talking about his life, his work, and his book, Return to the Moon, Exploration, Enterprise, and Energy in the Human Settlement of Space. I really enjoyed listening to you and learning from you, and hope that you'll come back and talk to us again.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and my best to your audience.
I'm honored. Thank you so much.